Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the heart of Baghdad's Green Zone, U.S. and Iranian diplomats posed for the cameras yesterday. It was the biggest break in nearly three decades in the deep freeze between Washington and Tehran. But what it means is still anybody's guess. This month, U.S. warships were wargaming off the coast of Iran. Tehran was arresting Iranian-Americans on espionage charges. Tehran's nuclear program was reported blazing full steam ahead. Dick Cheney was standing on an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf talking tough. Up next on Point, the U.S. now face-to-face with the Mideast's rising power, Iran. Joining me first today from Washington is Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Robin, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So what's come out of this, if anything?
Well, it's an important beginning. After all, the two countries have not had formal public talks for almost three decades. It's at a particularly important juncture for the United States, given its dire situation in Iraq. But it also comes at an interesting time for Iran because it's facing growing international pressure over its nuclear program. And if there's any sense, even though these talks are focused only on Iraq, that you can do business between the two, that then opens the potential anyway for more of a dialogue, more progress on other issues down the road.
Are you suggesting by that implicit here is help us get out of Iraq and you can have your nuclear weapons, Tehran? Is that the Washington position, unstated?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Not at all. But there's been a debate during this administration about how you deal with Iran. Could you trust it? Could you get it to back down on nuclear issues? Could you deal with it, frankly, on any issue? And there have been those in the administration who have argued that you have to at least make the effort, a position reflected, for example, in the Iraq Study Group report issued in January, a bipartisan panel urging that the United States try to engage with Iran in order to help stabilize Iraq. There are others who, particularly in the vice president's office, who have taken a much tougher line, believing that this hardline regime in Iran is as bad for American interests as the early days of the revolution in 1979 and the early 1980s.
Robin, leaving aside the bigger picture for a moment, exactly how could Tehran help the United States get out of Iraq or at least bring stability there?
Well, Iran has played a pivotal role through the Al-Quds force, its branch of the Revolutionary Guards, who are very active not only in Iraq but in other parts of the Middle East, such as Lebanon. And they have been providing, according to U.S. military sources, equipment that has been deadly for American troops, for Iraqi troops, and for Iraqi civilians. And the United States is particularly looking for the Iranians to pull back its activities, stop training the militias, which are, in theory anyway, illegal, stop providing them with some of the deadliest arms.
But, of course, the question is why they would do that. They went in and have provided these things in the first place, we're told. Robin, listen with me for just a moment, if you would, to U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker in his comments after the meeting, suggesting that there are sort of fundamental agendas on the same page here.
The Iranians, again, laid out their policy toward Iraq, their aims and goals in terms very similar to our own policy, and very similar to what the Iraqi government has set as its own a set of guiding principles. So from that point of view, I would say that the talks proceeded positively.
Robin, if our aims and goals are so much on the same page as Tehran, why has Tehran allegedly been sending, you know, high explosives in that have done so much damage to U.S. troops?
Well, I'm not in Tehran, but I can surmise that Iran has a particular interest in seeing the United States leave Iraq as soon as possible, and to leave Iraq battered, bruised, and unwilling to come back, particularly to engage in something like regime change in Iran. There's a broader agenda here. It's not just Iraq. I think Ryan Crocker was correct in saying that the two countries share an interest. They do. If the United States does pull out its troops and the violence continues unabated or escalates, Iran is in a very dangerous position. It will face the most unstable border among its allies in Iraq, and this, there's been tension between the two countries in the past. This is not something it wants to see happen long term.
So what materially could Iran do? Let's say the U.S. began to pull down forces. Iran doesn't want chaos in Iraq. How could it impose or encourage that if the United States, with all of its resources and troops, has not been able to?
Well, remember, the three largest Shiite parties in Iraq, who all have large representation in Iraq's parliament, are all closely aligned with Iran. Iran does have influence. Iran also has its own Sunni community. It has its own Kurdish community. And any instability in Iraq spills over. It has influence on all three sectors if it wants to use it. And that's important for the United States. That's why the issue here is, is making a viable dialogue that actually leads to something. Whether the Iranians want to do it is a different issue. But the mere fact that both sides came out of it talking about another meeting is a positive sign.
A big breakthrough just sitting down. Do you see this going forward, Robin? Or, do we run into the harder line crews in Washington and Tehran, which might be more interested in confrontation than talks?
Well, you're going to see two different mechanisms play out over the next few weeks. You have the movement in Iraq between the Iranians and the American envoys there. But you'll simultaneously see the European Union envoy meet with the Iranian National Security Advisor on Thursday to talk about Iran's nuclear program. The UN resolution was not complied with, the second one. The deadline was May 24th. The United States is now pushing, as are other members of the Security Council, for a third resolution because Iran has refused to cease its uranium enrichment, which is used for peaceful nuclear energy but can be subverted for the world's deadliest weapon.
So two tracks that may seem to go in different directions and very high stakes in between. Robin Wright with The Washington Post, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Washington is Ray Takhe, Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of Hidden Iran, Paradox and Power in the Islamic Republic. Ray Takhe, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
What do you see in this in the conversations we saw yesterday in Baghdad?
Well, a lot of it is similar to Robin was suggesting. I'm a little dubious of this exaggerated idea that this is the first discussions between United States and Iran in 28 years. There's been 8-9 previous attempts of a dialogue between the two countries over Afghanistan earlier, and of course the most notorious one being the Iran-Contra affair, which involved high-level discussions, and it's a curious lapse of memory for the current administration to suggest these talks are without precedent, given the fact that so many individuals involved in Iran-Contra affair were rehabilitated and now are part of the current Bush administration.
So they should know.
They should know that this is a larger record of discussion than the ones that are being portrayed. And curiously enough, Iranians are portraying it as a first important discussion in 28 years. Nevertheless, it's in a sense a recognition of the American difficulty in Iraq. If Iraq was stable and stabilizing, then it's hard to see why United States would reach out to Iran and ask for its assistance. Now, whether that assistance will be coming forth, it remains to be seen. I think to some extent that the objectives of the two countries, as Ryan Crocker said, are congruent. Iranians do want Shi empowerment, an empowerment that is likely to come through some degree of democratic process. And, on the other hand, you do have another important objective increasingly being in common, namely that both United States wants to leave Iraq and the Iranians want it to leave as well.
Do you see Tehran really stepping up to help the United States get out? There's been the notion out there that they were happy to see the U.S. get punished in Iraq. Has that agenda changed? Is Tehran seen enough punishment of the U.S. in these 4 years in Iraq?
Yeah, that's my view. I think the notion that they want the American forces to remain in Iraq and bleed is no longer relevant. I think they want the Americans out. They seem to think that the beast has bled enough and whatever ambitions America has had for transforming the Middle East has already been beaten out of it. So at this particular point, their interest is for an American withdrawal, for they seem to perceive that the regional countries can perhaps mediate Iraq's civil war.
And if the U.S. leaves, does Iraq become a client state of Iran with its Shiite-dominated democracy in Iraq?
I'm not quite sure if Iraq will become a client state, but it will become, at least this southern portion of Iraq, will become closely allied with Iran and the central government, which was going to be rather weak as well. I don't think it's going to be a subsidiary of Iran, but certainly it will have a different type of a relationship with Iran than it has ever had in the past century.
You've said we should go to détente with Iran, sort of drop our weapons, drop our hostility, break bread with Tehran. You know others in Washington are pushing very hard for a much harder-nosed approach. We had the vice president himself on the deck of an aircraft carrier just miles off the coast of Iran. So which is in the ascendant in Washington now, the hard line or the let's talk line?
I'm not all that certain which line is particularly prominent within the administration. I think given the difficulties that are being experienced in Iraq, it is likely that the United States will not want to broaden this sphere of confrontation. And this latest talks are an indication of it.
We're talking this hour about the U.S. and Iran, maneuvering over Iraq, and much, much more. U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker sat down with the Iranian ambassador in Baghdad yesterday. Here he is in a news conference following that meeting, saying that they had asked the Iranians to stop funding and arming and training militias in Iraq.
I laid out before the Iranians a number of our direct, specific concerns about their behavior in Iraq, their support for militias that are fighting both the Iraqi security forces and coalition forces, the fact that a lot of the explosives and ammunition that are used by these groups are coming in from Iran.
The explosives come in. Ray Takei says, though, it's time for détente. There are very different views in Washington as well, and we'll hear them in a moment. Let's get our listeners in here. From Savannah, Georgia, Justin is calling. Justin, you're on the air.
Good. How are you, Tom? Thanks for having me.
Sure. What do you know? What do you see?
I just think that we're at a critical point right now, and if this administration doesn't start some sort of dialogue with somebody, and I think Iran's as good as anyone, in that area that we're going to, the next administration is going to end up, you know, just headlong in something that's probably going to be unstoppable.
So you say time to talk, even with all the history we've got with Iran, hostages in the embassy and all the rest?
Everything. I mean, I think foreign relations in the next 20 years are going to have to be seen like that. We can't, you know, just carry on bad history, especially with the Middle East. God forbid something happened and, you know, a coalition of forces from that side were to, you know, that would just be devastating.
Yeah, Justin, we've got it. Let me get another call from Beaufort, South Carolina. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi. So I'd like to make one or two points. One is that Iran is not a monolithic bloc. From what I understand, there are a lot of different voices inside. They're trying to get ascendancy. And two, they were cooperating with us after the Afghanistan war until we called them the devils. I think there's a lot of reason why they can justly kind of be you know, say that they were damaged by us and at least ask for kind of peer, if not apologies, at least ask to be treated with respect. So I would, and if we don't, then I think we give support to the radical voice, Ahmadinejad and his minions, and make things work for ourselves. So I think we need to have a dialogue and look realistically at what's been going on the last 20 years that we're responsible for. Because if you look at the Middle East, I think there are actually some of the most moderate societies around there.
So reach out, have a dialogue with some modesty, you're suggesting. And Ray Takei, the suggestion there that we speak to Iran as peers,
You've written that Iran is not afraid of U.S. military power. As I read, you had a big piece in the Foreign Affairs just recently, the magazine. As I read you, you're saying we don't have any leverage here other than talking. I mean, that's basically all we've got, even as they apparently pursue nuclear weapons at a pace.
Well, our leverage is rather limited. I don't think it's we're completely without leverage. But, you know, the situation in Iraq, as it continues to deteriorate, the inevitability of a reduced American presence in the region, in the Gulf, the sort of a pervasive anti-Americanism and so forth, that's not exactly a situation where we want to find ourselves. It's not that dissimilar to the situation the United States was in the late 1960s, early 70s, when it was trying to leave a war, in that case Vietnam, and confronting a rising regional power, China. There are obviously certain dissimilarities, important dissimilarities. But the question now is, how do you regulate Iranian power in light of declining American presence in the Middle East?
We've had three aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf and 17,000 Marines and helicopters, you know, by the shipload out there doing military exercises. Are you saying all that is a sham? Are you saying we just have to put away the military option and stop talking about it, stop waving the gun?
I'm not quite sure, frankly, what those naval deployments are designed to achieve. Iran is not trying to invade its neighbors. It tends to project its influence in a more subtle way through terrorism, through subversion.
But not necessarily non-military. We saw their support in Lebanon last summer of a group there that put Israel on its knees.
Exactly. Its association with local Shi'i parties and militias. None of those particular activities are going to be curtailed by excessive militarization of the Gulf. If it's designed to put psychological pressure on Iran, given the fact that Iranian activities that we dislike remain consistent, it appears that the psychological pressure is not working. And it's a sort of a discursive aspect of the U.S. policy. On the one hand, there are discussions taking place with Iranians in Iraq, yet on the other hand, there is this augmented naval presence whose evident purpose is unclear to me. So we just have to make up our minds about which direction we want to go.
Though there are voices in Washington which think it's important to keep military force, front and center in this relationship. Reta Kay in Washington, please stand by for a moment. I want to turn to Ruhl Mark Gerecht. He joins us today from Brussels. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His work focuses on Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Served as an advisor to the Iraq Study Group. Ruhl Mark Gerecht, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
The Reta Kay is saying it's time for detente. We have to regularize our relations with a rising power in this region, and there's really no choice. You've written very recently, this regime in Tehran understands nothing other than brute force. What's the evidence of that, and what do you mean by that? That the U.S. should be prepared to go to war with Iran?
Well, I don't think you can describe the Islamic Republic as a regime that values soft power and has a strong preference for negotiations. I mean, I think the United States, under this administration, under the previous administration, under the first Bush administration, was willing at any time, actually, to have serious conversations with the clerical regime if the clerical regime was willing to have them. Problem is, the clerical regime isn't. What we have seen from this regime is terrorism. We have seen them attack us in the Gulf, most recently in 1996 in Saudi Arabia. By the way, the individuals who now rule the country, with the exception of Ahmadinejad, are the same individuals who were responsible for that attack, which killed 19 Americans and wounded 272 others.
Khobar Towers.
We have seen that Khobar Towers. We have seen them aid and abet al-Qaeda after the embassy attacks in Africa in 1998. Having very suspicious association with them, aiding and abetting a movement of members of al-Qaeda after those attacks.
But on the other hand, they sat down, as our caller said, post-Afghanistan and talked with the U.S. about cooperating there until the axis of evil phase.
I would dispute that, too. I mean, I think in 2003, I think Iran was a bit paralyzed with the thought that George W. Bush might actually mean what he said when he referred to the axis of evil. He had just dispensed one of them, Iraq, and they were concerned about that. Now, the discussion that the Iranians actually reached out with is a large program. That was largely generated by the Swiss ambassador in Iran at that time, and I don't think anyone takes that terribly credibly.
Ray Takei says you can't meaningfully take Iran on with military force now, that that's just not going to be effective. You say brute force is the only thing they understand. There's quite a gulf between...
I'm not saying it's the only thing. I'm saying that if you
this regime understands nothing other than brute force, your words...
That was at the end of a piece on Haleh Esfandiari, where I said that if you think that you can get away without using brute force, you're fooling yourself, that you need to be able to always have that on the forefront, to have them realize that you are willing to engage in military action, that if you catch them, for example, sending supplies, advanced military weaponry into Iraq to kill American and British soldiers, that you, in fact, are willing to respond to that with military power, and that you should absolutely do what the President of the United States ordered in September of 2006, and that has become much more aggressive in Iraq, at tracking down members of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who are responsible for bringing in these supplies and for aiding and abetting radical groups inside of Iraq.
Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Always value the discussion. The point I wanted to make is I just don't see how we can really have a democracy in Iraq with having a theistic background to it, that, you know, the point of having a Muslim democracy is just in itself flawed.
You mean you can't picture it backed by or supported by the theocracy in Tehran?
Exactly, and I think, you know, they have a nominal democracy themselves, but as long as the clerics are always in power, it's just a repeat of the Soviet Union-style democracy.
Ray Takei, how about it? Our caller doesn't see democracy springing out of the wells of Tehran. And Rulmar Correct points to the Americans now, plural, who are being held on espionage charges, including the 67-year-old American academic Haleh Esfandiari by Tehran. This hardly looks like an olive branch.
I would say in terms of the prospects of democracy in Iraq, first of all, it's important to understand that the Iraqi Shi community, clerical and otherwise, does not want to emulate the Iranian model of direct assumption of power by the clerics. So it is possible for you to have some degree of electoral representation and even democratic pluralism in Iraq. It's possible for Iraq to develop differently than Iran. And the Iranian support for democratic process in Iraq has nothing to do with their embrace of such ideals. It has to do with their perception that the democratic process empowers the Shi community, weakens the Sunni community, and creates a decentralized Iraq where the power is diffused to the provinces. Such decentralized Iraq obviously works to the benefit, the strategic benefit of Iran, because it is unlikely to contest Iranian power in the Gulf. Weak central governments don't have strong standing armies. As far as the series of hostages, the American hostages that are being held in Iran, Esfandiari and Takhbash, and there are four, I believe. This reflects the fact that this is a regime that is paranoid about its internal security to the point of manufacturing evidence, to the extent that there is even evidence against these individuals. And it also is a curious proposition, because it is the Bush administration that did not even bring out the fate of these hostages in its negotiations with Iran. Frankly, if I was in charge of U.S. policy, I'm not even sure if I would have the meeting that Ryan Crocker just had with the Iranians. I would have said to them privately a week or two ago that if these hostage crises continue, we'll revisit our approach to this particular meeting and perhaps even look to canceling it. Now, I do believe
that's
in
a
dialogue.
Long way from the blanket detente you've been promoting.
I was just going to say, I do believe in dialogue between United States and Iran and even moving toward normalization, but not dialogue at any price and not dialogue at any time. It would be, to me, it's rather curious that the administration that calls for moral clarity in its foreign policy, administration that suggests such values animates its international relations, does not even bring up the fate of Esfandiari and others. At least I would have brought it up and suggest to them that this is an inappropriate behavior toward American citizens being held against their will.
Real Mark, correct a couple of things. First of all, if the United States is looking to exit or draw down its presence with the cooperation of Iran, what, to your mind, does that portend for Iraq and Iraq's democracy and the structure of Iraq? Do you see a client state? Do you see a democracy? Do you see a mirror of the Iranian theocracy?
Well, one, I don't think the United States is going to draw down with the help of Iran. I don't. I mean, the Iranians, unfortunately, I think the signal the United States has sent to Iran is that you continue to move very aggressively on developing nuclear weapons. Two, you export lethal weaponry to Iraq, which is used to kill American and British soldiers. Three, you seize American-Iranians inside of Iran. And then the Americans come to this meeting, and you have members of the National Security Council publicly say that, you know, we hope that we can work to have some type of dialogue on the future of Iraq.
Yeah, that's the whole point, right?
Right. Well, it would implying that we'd like. Now, that's, I would argue, a very, very bad signal to send. I mean, they're acting in a very aggressive manner, and you wanting to sit down and chat.
So you're interpreting that, but the fact is the sit-down took place, and the sole agenda,
well,
we were told.
Nothing. I mean, the sit-down, actually, I think Ambassador Crocker, I think, put it very well when he said it's not clear there's going to be another meeting. And I think if you read between the lines, I mean, the Department of State would describe such a meeting as being positive unless a food fight broke out. But in reality, I'm not sure much at all happened. I think the leader of Iran, Khamenei, had given a speech a week before, laying out a pretty tough hardline position, very consistent for him.
Ray Takei says that leadership in Tehran is not afraid of the U.S. militarily at this point. So is there a real option on the military path, Real Mark Gorecht? If diplomacy isn't the active, you know, live wire, if it doesn't work or won't, is there really a military option?
Well, it depends which issue you're talking about. If you're talking about nuclear weapons, certainly there's an option. I mean, if the United States or Israel chooses to, there are enormous risks involved. I would say they are less than allowing Iran to go nuclear. You can preempt and destroy the principal nuclear sites. Now, in dealing with other issues, you must have a military threat present. I mean, we should have been much rougher on Iran earlier on the issue of terrorism. And certainly on their interference in Iraq, I would argue the correct approach is that taken by the Bush administration since September of 2006. And that is, if you catch the Iranians in the act in Iraq, you respond forcefully. You will seize their personnel. If you catch them in any type of cooperation with violent forces, you will kill them. And that, I would argue, is a much better approach. The notion that Iran is going to help the United States in Iraq, I find pretty far-fetched. They certainly, I would argue, want the United States out. They have gained by the violence in the country. They certainly have gained by the lame way we have handled the occupation.
Real Mark Gorecht, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Ray Takei joins us from Washington. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations. And right now, also from Washington, we're joined by Steve Clemens, director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He writes the blog The Washington Note, where he covers foreign policy, defense, and international economic policy. Steve Clemens, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So you're describing recently in The Washington Note a kind of shadow American policy almost shadow American government. You described Dick Cheney as having lost confidence in the president on the tough stance with Iran, and sort of, as I read you, plotting a kind of shadow policy or promoting it that would push the nation closer to military confrontation. Is this just guesswork, or is there real evidence of this stuff?
Well, I think that there's real evidence that a senior aide to Vice President Cheney has been expressing on behalf of the vice president frustration with the president. That's what's remarkable to me, not the issue that Vice President Cheney might be on the side of a harder-edged policy towards Iran. I think the president has been deploying a full range of options, you know, ranging from Cheney on that aircraft carrier to the diplomatic efforts of Ryan Crocker, Nick Burns, and Condi Rice and others. But the big issue that seems to be happening right now, at least of a senior Cheney aide, and again, this is not, I can't put words in Cheney's mouth as this other person did, is saying that he's afraid that they'll lose the policy argument with Bush and with others in the administration, and that they felt that they needed to begin deploying an end-run strategy around the president. And that's really remarkable. That's something we haven't seen before.
And you describe that, an end-run strategy, in what terms?
Well, in the case of how this person described it, it would be trying to nudge Israel forward to engage in not a comprehensive bombing of Iran, but sort of a prick, a low-level cruise missile attack on the Natanz reactor that might predictably precipitate an exchange or response back from Iran to some of our forces in the region. That would then remove from the president's, you know, set of policy options, as they see it, the chance to, I think it would take diplomacy off the table, and it would probably produce a much harder or a narrow choice that the President of the United States would have in terms of responding to Iran in that case. And this is really remarkable, because if this is in fact true, I know what is true is I know the individual said it. What I don't know is how real this is and what Vice President Cheney really thinks. But if in fact this is in fact what the vice president thinks, then it is remarkable to have a situation where the vice president is denigrating the president and actually trying to put himself at odds in very tangible ways with the president's policy, which I think has been tacking towards the diplomatic direction, along with a bit of muscle with the troops in the region.
Ray Take, this is hard for us to get our heads around, the sort of span of things being described here. You, on the one hand, saying drop the rough language, stop denouncing Iran as an outpost of tyranny, normalize relations, go for detente. And on the other hand, and we saw the meeting yesterday in Baghdad, seeming evidence of a leaning in that direction. On the other hand, talk of an end-run strategy and military action, maybe by Israel, that would lock America into a more confrontational, force-based relationship with Iran. Where do you see this going?
Well, I really don't have a sort of idea about the inner workings of the Bush administration. I don't have any particular access to them. What I would say is they seem to have a two-track strategy. One track is serious, of course, of measures involving naval deployments in the Gulf, Security Council resolutions, informal financial sanctions, and tough rhetoric. On the other hand, there's a flexible component to it where they call for negotiations, really on a comprehensive set of issues, should Iran be willing to suspend an enrichment component of its program, nuclear program, for a brief period of time, I think even a month. The problem with the two-track policy is that one track negates the other, and therefore a suitable environment for comprehensive and sustained negotiations isn't being created. That's the problem with this two-track policy, as I see it now. Yeah. Whether there are machinations within the administrations to provoke conflict and run the president, I really have no evidence, or I just don't know about that.
And I want to be sure we get the heart of your argument on the table, and that is, as I read it, that the U.S. Is deluding itself if it thinks it has the brute force of any kind, diplomatic or military, to bend Tehran to its will, that Tehran has gained so much strength in recent years that the U.S. really has no choice but to treat it as it treated the Soviet Union, i.e. get into detente, build the kind of relationships, embroider sort of regulations and normalize behavior around Iran. But there's no way to just bend Tehran to the American will. No way, which the American people have not really been told. It's not suggested by the president's posture.
Well, I'm not quite sure if a series of coercive measures at our disposal at this point are going to have a meaningful impact on Iran's national security priorities. And the evidence of that is rather clear. And the evidence of that can be gleaned from the administration's own rhetoric. They're the ones that suggest Iran's nuclear program is proceeding, and they are right. They are the ones that have suggested Iran is being mischievous in Lebanon and the Gulf and Iraq, and they may very well be right. So therefore, they, in essence, acknowledge the failure of their policy, in a sense that Iran's behavior is not improving. The question then becomes, how do you improve Iran's behavior, and how do you make sure that Iran adheres to certain standards and norms? And the purpose of détente with the Soviet Union was designed to create a system, a sort of a web of mutually reinforcing economic and strategic incentives for Soviet Union to, as Henry Kissinger said, wants to be contained. And that's the situation that I was trying to suggest we may create with Iran. It may not work, but at this particular point, the environment for such negotiations has not been created.
Mm. And Steve Clemens, is the implication of your reporting that there's a significant view within the Bush administration or the vice president's office that doesn't believe that military force is you know, nearing the end of its utility, that still thinks brute strength, despite all the bleeding of American military force in Iraq, is or must be an option?
I think the kind of cost-benefit analysis and the rationality that Ray Takei, and I agree with everything he said, or I would ascribe to this situation, doesn't hold for other friends of ours in this game, like Reuel Marcoret or Michael Ledeen or an American Enterprise Institute senior fellow or Vice President Cheney and some of his close staff members like David Addington and John Hanna. I think they believe that it is patriotic, it is important for American national security not to engage in declinism, not to engage in what they consider to be appeasement, and that they think that we've got what is necessary to continue to try to engineer massive change in the Middle East, regime change in a country-by-country basis, and I believe that they not only think that it's possible and rational, but right. I strongly disagree with their views.
Do you accept then that Iran will become a nuclear armed power? Is that part and parcel of walking away from the hard nose position?
I think Iran is on the way to becoming a country that looks a lot like Japan,
Japan doesn't have nuclear weapons.
It doesn't have nuclear weapons, but it has a full fuel cycle nuclear capacity and can become a nuclear power rather quickly.
You think Iran would stop there? It could be induced to stop there?
I think it will be induced to stop there for a lot of regional reasons, most of which have to do with instant proliferation completely around it, from everywhere, from Egypt and Saudi Arabia. It's already got troubles with India and Pakistan. I think that that to break into a full weaponization program
I haven't seen any influence in that decision, but I'm saying that's where
Iran thinks it's going, in my view.
Ray, I want to get you on that right away, if I can. Do you think they'll just walk up to the line but not go over it, Ray Takei? Is that reasonable? All the rhetoric seems to be it's our right to pursue, you know, it doesn't line up with what I'm reading anywhere.
Well, in terms of public rhetoric of Iran, they have suggested that they want a nuclear energy program, not nuclear weapons program. There's no reason to credit that rhetoric. But what is being suggested is a different type of a relationship with the United States and a different type of relationship between Iran and the global community can perhaps create barriers where, again, Iran would see it in its interest to restrain some of its impulses. It may want to have a nuclear weapons program, but if in a different situation, in a different context, in a different set of relationships, perhaps it will adhere to its non-proliferation commitments. That's essentially the purpose of a détente-based policy, is to create internal conditions where a country wants to behave in a normal, predictable way.
Do you think the odds of Iran going nuclear are greater on the path we're on now, or if we ratchet up the military pressure, or if we go to détente? Or is it inevitable that it becomes a nuclear-armed power, period?
Well, I don't believe in life or in history anything is inevitable. If you believe something is inevitable, then why show up in the morning?
Well, they've got more than 1,000 centrifuges spinning right now. We're told that the enrichment's going on apace. They could start turning out plenty of fuel to do it.
they got actually close to 2,000 centrifuges building up to 50,000. An enrichment capability that is capped and limited to 4% enrichment gradation is not necessarily a weapons grade. Obviously, the country has a technological capability that could essentially allow it to cross the threshold if it chooses to. And what you want to do is create a strategic calculus where it will choose not to. I would agree with your question in one respect, that Iran will have a nuclear infrastructure of some significance no matter what policy one pursues. The question is, can you create a framework where that infrastructure is not abused for military purposes?
But it could be a distinction without a difference if it's all but nuclear armed but has full capability and could flip the switch at any point. Let's go to our listeners, if I may. George is calling from Boston. George, you're on the air.
Hi, Don. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask a question. It's kind of like a double standard that this regime has.
Okay.
Why do we continuously point Iran as an Islamic devil while we have a very close ally in Saudi Arabia, which we know is, in fact, an Islamic theocracy with, I believe, worse human rights than Iran, not allowing women their proper rights, minorities, and other religious groups?
George, maybe because Saudi Arabia has been an ally and Iran has been a fierce opponent of the United States?
But we also forget that most of the people who had the terrorist attack on us on September 11th were from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. No, let us pick it up. Ray Tuckey, what about it? George sees the theocracy in Tehran, but also in Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. doesn't seem to have a problem with that.
Well, Saudi Arabia has, for a long time, curiously enough, been exempt from accountability for its conduct. Saudi Arabia has been the main subsidizer of radical Islamic movements in the Middle East throughout the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and so on. Saudi Arabia, as mentioned, has a very poor domestic human rights record and is certainly a non-representative government. But Saudi Arabia has also been a country with a very strong PR representation in the United States and has managed to, as I said, exempt accountability. And to be sure and to be fair, during the 1970s and 1960s, when Saudi Arabia was the incubator of radical Islam, we supported that in the 1960s because we saw them as a counterpoint to radical Arab nationalism as embodied by Egypt. In the 1970s, we favored Saudi Islam because it would essentially counter radical fundamentalism of Iranian variety and certainly cooperated with it in Afghanistan, where it fueled such Islamic tendencies. So for a long time, we tended to view Saudi policy of export and subsidy of Islamist movement as consistent with our strategic objectives. That became untenable in the aftermath of 9/11, where we seem to have a different perceptions of this, but at this point we have not been able
to
superimpose our demands on Saudis.
Right, but Saudi Arabia has not tried to drive the United States out of the Middle East. Iran talks that kind of language.
Yes, but it's hard to see at the time when the United States has 180,000 forces in Iraq and significant naval armada in the Gulf how successful Iranian policy of eviction of America has been. And again, the policy that Iran should be the Gulf security protector did not originate with the Islamic Republic. It was a Shah of Iran's policy, and to some extent we subsidized it and supported that. But yeah, Saudi Arabia has certainly a different view of American presence in the Middle East. But its policies on entire range of issues, including the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where it is now subsidizing Hamas to the tune of $1 billion, has not always been consistent with American priorities.
Steve Clemens, where do you see this situation heading? I mean, Americans watch on. We see talks in Baghdad. At the same time, we all saw the vice president on the aircraft carrier.
Right. I know it's a lot of conflicting images. I think the situation is fragile, and I think that, you know, Ray Tuckey gets it right in terms of talking about the sort of packages of incentives and disincentives that we and other nations together can cobble together. I'll tell you a couple of things that I think are missing in the debate. First of all, those people who think that this is the highest level encounter between American and Iranian diplomats are wrong in the last 27 years. We very successfully worked with Iran in 2002 to help work with Iran to stabilize Afghanistan.
Yeah, we've heard that point, but here we are today, not exactly in pastures of peace.
No, but we're not the pastures of peace, but what we've seen Ryan Crocker and others achieve at least is at least opening the door and getting a toehold back into a diplomatic track. Now, we ought not to deceive ourselves that everything will be easy, but nonetheless, it may be moving us back into that period around 2002 and early 2003 where things in U.S.-Iranian relations were moving in a positive direction.
Is this now Condi Rice versus Dick Cheney?
Rice,
and if it is, who
Bob
wins?
Gates. A lot of people look at the military dimension of this negatively. I think the important thing is that CENTCOM commander William Fallon resisted the White House pressure for him to ask for a third carrier strike force group to go out to the Gulf. I think that you're seeing an integration and solid support of not only Bob Gates at the Department of Defense, Mike Hayden at CIA, and Mike McConnell at the Directorate of National Intelligence, all working together functionally rather than the highly dysfunctional pattern that we saw up until there was a high-level shuffle of appointments, and that this has been the biggest change in this White House. And what the president has done is thrown his support at least to sort of see what they can produce, and that has created this kind of, I think, a major shift in the direction of the White House. That opens up possibilities. Now, Iran could continue to misbehave. Iran could continue to sort of not go off its course or find anything. But so far, we see attack in the right direction. But it's very, very fragile.
Well, watch this space. The span of options and outlooks there is quite remarkable to behold. With that, we're out of time. Steve Clemens at the New America Foundation, thank you very much for joining us. And Ray Takei at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ray, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.